Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Jim Strandberg from the Alaska Energy Authority discusses South Central's energy plan for the next 50 years. In early December, Strandberg and his team released the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan, a long-range state-funded energy plan identifying combinations of generation and transmission capital improvement projects in the Rail Belt region of Alaska. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project, who is a nonprofit contributor to KSKA's programming, hosted Jim Strandberg's talk at the Anchorage Museum on December 9th.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Renewable Energy Alaska Project's monthly forum, and Jim Strandberg is going to be presenting tonight. I'm very excited to be having this topic tonight. And before we get started, I just want to make a couple announcements. In terms of the presentation, we're going to have about a half an hour presentation. And while Jim's talking, we'll be passing out note cards. So if you would fill out your questions on the note cards, and then we'll have a question and answer session after that. Just a little bit of background. Renewable Energy Alaska Project, if you're not familiar with us, we're a nonprofit. We're based in Anchorage. We do education and advocacy on renewable energy and energy efficiency. And this is a topic that's very dear to Renewable Energy Alaska Project's mission. We've basically, one of our key goals is securing Alaska's long-term energy future. And I think it kind of goes without saying why that's an important issue in terms of for us as businesses, in terms of us as people who live in Alaska and want to see jobs here and see a future for our children here. And I think this is an issue that is very timely. I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say that energy is one of the key issues facing the state in terms of securing our long-term supply of energy, if not the key issue for the state. And I think it's always hit me the irony, Alaska having such vast resources of energy from fossil to renewable, and yet here we are paying some of the highest prices in the nation for energy and suffering as a result of that. And I think everybody's aware of the situation in rural Alaska where the high prices are basically crippling the economies there, in some cases leading to an exodus from communities because people simply can't afford to live there anymore. I think people are less aware, maybe not so much in this room, but just the general public in terms of the energy crisis facing South Central Alaska, and maybe crossroads is a better term for it, but just one way that you might say it is people might say we've had a pretty good run. We've had cheap, available, relatively cheap, available natural gas for the last four decades, and that in a way is kind of a fluke because that was gas that was discovered sort of accidentally while they were searching for oil down in the Kenai. So it's kind of fluke that we've had that for the last four decades, but we've had a good run with it and we've prospered. But now the supply of that relatively cheap available natural gas is running low. And in fact, last winter, the utility managers were running so short that they were worried about losing pressure in the gas lines. And okay, well, why is that important? Well, if you lose pressure in the gas lines, you would actually lose the pilot lights at our homes and businesses. And this part is direct from the utility managers. The effort to go and relight all those pilot lights would be a process that could take a month or longer because you need utility folks going house to house. So that's not a good situation to be in if you live in a cold climate, and the likelihood that something like that would happen would be in the wintertime. Now, that's a very unlikely scenario. We hope it doesn't happen, and this winter, the city and the utilities have been working together, and they have a plan in place that if they start to see a situation developing where we're getting close to that line, they have steps they would take to avoid losing pressure in the line. But at the very end of those steps is rolling blackouts. So we would be, you know, potentially, hopefully not, and again, the risk is very low that this would happen, but that's not a good situation in terms of having an energy supply you can count on. So sort of back to our talk tonight, we're facing some really big challenges, and we also have some big opportunities in terms of figuring out where our long-term supply of energy comes from. And there's lots of options out there on the table, from an in-state gas line to more development of the Cook Inlet gas fields to tapping more renewable power, like a hydropower system at Lake Chacachamna across Cook Inlet, which would provide, I believe it's 330 megawatts of power, which is about a third of our maximum load right now, to geothermal power at Mount Spur. And in fact, there's a company right now that spent $3.2 million for the exploration leases there on Mount Spur and is exploring for geothermal right now. So there's lots of options. None of them are cheap. We can't do them all. And what is so important about this report that Jim is going to talk about tonight, the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan, is that it attempts to help us decide between those options, and not just for the short term, for the long term. So it looked at a 50-year timeline and trying to help us make those decisions so we're not just taking the cheapest option, but one that's going to pay off in the long term. And that kind of goes without saying, that's a real helpful thing. So it's a good starting point for that. Jim is far more steeped in that report, in the details of the report, than I am. So I'm really looking forward to his talk tonight. And I also, just a little background on Jim, I think he is a person who has a deep base of knowledge about power issues in the state. He is a professional engineer by trade. He's a lifelong Alaskan. He actually worked on the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline Design Team. And before joining the Alaska Energy Authority, he spent the past 7 years as a utility commissioner with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, which oversees utility in the state. So he's got a good grounding in the issues from that. Now with the Alaska Energy Authority, he has a vaunted title that I'm still puzzling over, Senior Project Manager, which hardly seems to encapsulate all that he does over there. But I do know that he has headed up the effort on this report, and that's why he's here tonight. So please help me welcome Jim Strandberg of Alaska Energy Authority.
Good evening, folks. I've crafted just a short presentation for you, which I hope that you'll find interesting. I tend to be an extemporaneous speaker. There's another word, Stephanie. And I'll really attempt to get to the gut issues that face us. Obviously, on a cold and foggy evening, for people to come out, you have conviction and want to hear about the state's work, and I appreciate that. I am Jim Strandberg. I've been with the Energy Authority now for 3 years, and we've been working on this rail belt issue. I also have interest down in Southeast Alaska on their interties and networks, and it's been an interesting pathway. Tonight, we are really, the subject is the one element of the restructuring of the rail belt to meet our energy future, the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan. We have been talking about this as a group, as a people, as a region, now for months and months and months. I guess the takeaway here is while the sky is not falling, it is definitely a time to act with respect to rebuilding and adding on to our critical infrastructure so that we can continue to enjoy our quality of life. Now, I want to get just down to the two fundamentals. And basically, you and I, as consumers, want to have inexpensive and reliable power. And we have a number of certificated public utilities, six of them to be exact, that are tasked by their certificates with the RCA to provide that. And in order for them to continue to provide that, MLMP, Shugetch, MEA, HEA, Golden Valley, City of Seward, MLMP, every one of those utilities needs access to reliable wholesale power. That's really what we're about today. Now, there's been some discussion of the need to consolidate the utilities' distribution portions of their businesses so that we don't, you know, we no longer have MLMP or Shugetch, but we maybe combine them for the city. And there's been some discussion of that, but this study does not deal with that. Now, I will say it may be a subject, an upcoming subject, but today we really want to talk about the generation and the transmission aspects of our infrastructure. And just to put it in perspective, the G&T elements of our systems are the most expensive. It just costs a heck of a lot of money to build a power generator or to build a transmission line. Some of these projects have gestation periods that exceed 10 years. Indeed, some of the hydro projects that we're considering, it may take between 10 and 15 years to build them, depending on what the permitting issues arise. So just a takeaway here is we're dealing with the most expensive portion of our infrastructure, and that is, the generation and transmission. And I would make the comment that right now these are owned by private, not-for-profit public utilities. They have a public purpose, and the asset value of that infrastructure is very significant in terms of how much stuff up here is actually owned by Alaskans. Okay, so another fundamental is a lot of people don't express this, but in fact, the work that the Alaska Energy Authority is doing, we seek really to develop a controlled economic development path for the next 50 years. And we also, underlying all of this work we do, we seek to maintain our special Alaskan quality of life. And we can't lose sight of that, because indeed, our ability to capitalize, to create a stable, reliable power grid that we can afford is absolutely fundamental for us all to be able to live up here and have our kids grow up and stay here and to have a decent quality of life. Now, before I get into the actual integrated plan, and I'll just tell you, I have some comments on some national trends with respect to the use of renewable energy. I will describe the integrated plan process after that. And then finally, I'll give you some relatively high-level results from the planning. And I'll do that in a relatively small number of slides. And certainly, if there is a yen here within the audience, we can have some Q&A. I would also like to, at this point, introduce Mr. Kevin Harper. Kevin, would you stand up and give a wave? Kevin is the Black & Veatch project manager. The Alaska Energy Authority has hired his firm to actually do the planning work for us. And even though the guy is an engineer, he doesn't dress stodgy or anything or look like Dilbert, and actually he did a pretty good job. And that's one engineer to another. So The information I'll provide you is a little technical, but I'll walk you through these graphs. I think they're fairly interesting with respect to the role that renewable energy is likely to play in our energy future. In a recent magazine, a mechanical engineering magazine, and I happen to be a registered mechanical and civil engineer, and I find myself always helping these darn electrical engineers with their problems because they just sometimes can't fight their way out of a paper bag. This mechanical engineering magazine reported in an analysis of technologies and which ones are likely to see central use in our country's energy solutions and which ones may be falling aside. What the article says is that wind and geothermal power appear to be entering their most fruitful phase, while fossil fuel power looks to be stagnating. An interesting concept, in as much as we've always in the past relied on coal power, on natural gas power, and indeed many of the solutions in the lower 48 involve significant uses of coal. Now, this particular slide comes right out of the magazine article, and I wanted to just explain it to you. This typical S-curve describes the life of a technology where, at the very beginning, the technology is very creates very expensive power. And if you look on that vertical axis, that's kilowatt hours per dollar, well, that's actually 1 over the rate. So, for example, 20 kilowatt hours per dollar is equivalent to 5 cents a kilowatt. So as you move up the curve, the power actually becomes less expensive. On the lower horizontal axis is plotted the cumulative investment in research and development. And what that says is, as a technology such as wind matures, you spend more and more money on R&D, and you come out with better and better products. And they're saying now that there's major amounts of R&D going into wind worldwide, so that the prices for wind power are falling rather dramatically. And you can see that wind is still not mature. It's, like maybe 25 years old. I think, an important concept, the maturity of the technologies that we're actually seeking to employ here in Alaska. So here is another example. This is geothermal. And this particular economist developed numbers, again, on what the relative price of the power is versus the cumulative research and development numbers that have gone into that technology. And as you can see, geothermal is not as advanced as wind is, and its prices, because it's down low, is still very high. But there is an expectation it'll follow that S-curve. Now, here's an interesting plot on the same axis for fossil energy. And what you can see is that and there's limited data on this, but as more and more R&D money went in to the technology, for example, I'm going to say that's $30,000 million have been devoted to R&D for coal-fired plants, gas-fired plants, that the price, really is quite cheap. And as more and more money was put into it, it reached a peak, a low for the cost of energy from those fossil fuels. But then later on, even though they continued to invest, the price started to increase again. And that is what is happening because of the world price of fossil fuels. And there's some expectation of carbon tax in there. So the expectation is the relative competitiveness of these forms of energy over the long haul may become less, while the relative competitiveness of the renewable energy sources could actually improve. I think it's just an interesting counterpoint that what's happening in the lower 48, and indeed, we have been isolated in Alaska with our gas bubble in south central Alaska and the extensive amounts of hydropower in southeast and the relatively low cost of diesel in the rest of the state. But our energy future is evolving now, and some of these rather rough-cut issues are beginning very much to penetrate into our lifestyles. And so with that context, I wanted to move right into the integrated planning and to really discuss this with you. Now, you've got to have a vision. The vision that AEA has worked with, and indeed it's worked with the utilities, we've had extensive discussions about this, is we want to go from where we are right now, which is limited redundancy, limited economies of scale, difficult financing, we've got duplicate expertise between utilities, and we want to transition over like a 10-year period to come up with a new world order, if you will, of a diversified fuel supply, system-wide power rates with significant financial assistance from the state, and, of course, the regional planning. Now, the current project that we have, the Integrated Resource Plan, is this part of the equation, and hopefully it expresses what the wise resource use is. So now, just before we get into this, I wanted to give you a couple of descriptions of the acronyms that AEA and the Railbelt utilities are using. There have been three discrete tasks. The REGA study, which Mr. Harper also authored, was really accomplished to make recommendation on what the best kind of business will be to own and operate the generation and transmission assets of the future. The GRETSI initiative is a joint effort between AEA, the governor's office, and the Railbelt utilities to form a law, a statute, which basically creates a very specialized corporation, which is controlled by the utilities, but which has significant financing capabilities and can really enter into public-private partnerships with the state, also is a very robust company that has the ability to take on very large projects. So it's pretty simple. It's just a specialized public interest company. Finally, the RIRP is the project that we are reporting on now, and which we just introduced the report. Mr. Harper's group produced this report. It is on our webpage, and it's the economic plan for how we should invest in new generation and transmission. So let's just talk about the fundamentals of this plan. Now, we're getting a little more granular. We're focused now on the planning for the generators and the transmission lines and the fuel supplies that we will need in order to produce this inexpensive wholesale power that we all need for our economic well-being up here. And just the takeaway from this slide is that this planning involves not only the generators, power generators, but also the transmission lines that connect, and fuel portfolio projects, particularly for the natural gas side of things. And just quickly, we've considered all of the viable energy sources which exist here, and there is quite the list. We've got hydro energy, wind energy, geothermal energy. We have considered tidal and hydrokinetic, but at the present time, the mature technologies really center around hydropower, the geothermal power, and the wind power. We also, of course, consider natural gas, coal, and petroleum. Okay, what kind of power plants? We talked about the energy sources. Well, we've got the fossil fuel power plants, the coal-fired plants. There's basically two of them, one of them operating, one owned by Golden Valley Electric Association, the Unit 1 at Healy River. And, of course, the other one is the famous Healy Clean Coal Project, which is currently, shall we say, on standby, awaiting resolution of the potential sale from our sister agency, ADA, to Golden Valley Electric Association. Of course, we've got a lot of natural gas plants. We've got the Beluga plant. We've got the George Sullivan plant, to name two. Homer Electric has a power plant at its Nikiski Industrial Facility. And then we have a number of hydroelectric power plants. The wind generation, there's a number of wind projects that are being proposed, and certainly through our renewable energy grant program, we have awarded significant grants to wind projects throughout the rail belt. And then there is one geothermal plant which is being considered at the base of Mount Spur by Ormat. So how does this integrated resource plan work with the proposed GRETC bill? Remember, GRETC is that new special purpose private company that's controlled by the utilities, by board members, but also within the statute there are specific public responsibilities. Well, this is kind of a busy slide, and suffice it to say, we've got the integrated planning process, which is really designed to be used by the new company, GRETC. And GRETC would have a number of inputs to it. First is to have financial life breathed into it through participation by the Rail Belt utilities and the state. And it's really defined by the REGA study. The REGA study found that there'd be significant savings for all of the ratepayers in the Rail Belt were we able to combine the generation and transmission assets. And of course, this process is designed for us to bring online the major generation and transmission assets and to have them efficiently operated so that people's lights stay on over the long run. Now, this integrated plan conforms with this company, these company organizational concepts, and it assumes that we're going to transition from where we are now over a 10-year period to this company which has been able to finance and build these large projects, some of them may be hydros, and to provide all of the utilities in the Rail Belt a system-wide, inexpensive rate with equal reliability, and to have our fuel security and our energy security ensured, because rather than depending only on gas, we will have a number of different energy sources. This is the vision and the goal, and this is what the integrated plan actually proposes. We expect that this plan, it's 391 pages long, but we do have a good executive summary in it, and I'll credit Mr. Harper for that, that the new company will make major use of this. And our agency, we expect, may actually serve as a banker or a bonding entity. That's what AEA can do, is to sell bonds, i.e. finance large-scale public interest projects. And we expect the legislature will be quite interested in this project because it does lay out what are credible projects and which ones we should really begin to spend money on. And I want to reemphasize this as a directional document. We can't just go out and start writing checks on the basis of this document. There's going to be additional work between the state and the utilities, and it all depends on cooperation. The integrated plan assumes that this new company would be formed. And the conclusions of Black & Veatch is that while it's not impossible to pursue our integrated plan without GRETSI, but it would be pretty darn hard. Now, let's get down into the way the plan was done. There's a thing called the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and I think probably most of you are familiar with that concept, where through energy policy, a state mandates that a certain portion of its energy needs to come from renewable sources. This plan made use of the rudimentary or the basic renewable portfolio standard that was really introduced by Governor Palin, which is to achieve 50% of our energy for the rail belt from renewable sources by the year 2025. And so we basically looked at the economic or the development of the rail belt G&T in two ways. One is without that renewable portfolio standard, and the other is with it. And so, for example, what we were looking for is to see if there was a cost associated with us really building things so that we made major use of renewable energy. And I'll just tell you that the basic result of the study was there was no cost differential between just saying we're just going to build the cheapest fossil-fueled and go with the most economic approach versus saying, no, we're going to go build renewables. It doesn't cost us any more to build renewables. Now, the other part of this is that we looked at the business as usual with relatively low growth rates for the rail belt over the 50 years. But we weren't sure about that because if we got reliable and inexpensive power, and lo and behold, some industry came up here and wanted to use a lot of power, that might increase the loads. And so we considered a high growth case. With Kevin, that was two times. Is that correct? Basically, two times the growth rate. So under that high growth rate, we also looked at just no renewable portfolio standard for our development, just being able to pick the cheapest fossil fuel or renewable projects, and also the one with that renewable portfolio standard. And again, there was really no difference in the economic cost. We did look at in detail at the Susitna hydropower project. And certainly there are two major projects. One is called Chakachamna, which is situated, again, over near Mount Spur. And that's, you know, right at the mouth of Merrill Pass for any aviators there. And that project is a lake tap project, meaning there really isn't a dam associated with it. So the cost of that is significantly lower than the Susitna project, which involves dams. Now, there are definitely trade-offs here. I want to just stress that there are uncertainties here, particularly with the Chakachamna project, with respect to its permitting. And we need to look for any sort of deal killer aspects of these projects. And unfortunately, we have Coke bottle bottom glasses. So between those two projects, the Susitna project and the Chakachamna, there were definite differences. The Susitna project, the state has spent $130-some million on that project, so it knows a lot about it, and that project does not have fish issues. Chakachamna, there has not been a lot of development funds really spent on that, and there appear to be fish issues. So we are in somewhat of a conundrum in being able to see clearly and actually make any sort of recommendation about which one of those projects to choose. So basically, and I'll just say this right, maybe a little out of order, the study recognizes that there are risks between those, and it really is unable to make a final selection on either one of those, but it does recommend that we do further development work, and later on, when we know more, to actually pick the horse. Here's a nice picture of the Susitna River. It is truly a beautiful project. It'll be a pretty penny to build it, but there are, again, many, many positive aspects to both of these projects that will need to be evaluated. Okay. Here are some basic results. Now, I thought that Mr. Harper's group did a nice job presenting this. If you look at the horizontal axis, this is the 50-year time period that the planning that we required them to plan for. Now, each one of those, and in particular, the vertical axis, is the amount of energy, again, by year, that would be required by the rail belt and the breakdown of where that energy will come from. And you can see the red, kind of the red and the chartreuse, are the wind projects, and there's some municipal solid waste projects which really did come out quite good in the economic competition. The this is geothermal, which is basically the Mount Spur project, and again, we're making the assumption that Ormat, the private developer, will, and I hate to say this term, but come up with hot rocks where there's water. And they're going to drill this summer, and we'll know more this summer about that project. The yellow is the hydro. And that basically represents, under the present circumstance, I believe the Chacachamna energy. Is that correct, Kevin? Yes. And the blue here is the coal energy. And the plan basically currently assumes that the Healy Unit 1 will operate for a period of time but then be retired. And the plan does currently not select the Healy Clean Coal Project. So in essence, the power portfolio will not involve coal after the year 2020. And I'd like to ask you to kind of reflect on those earlier slides that I was showing you about the expected trajectory that fossil energy will have in the nationwide power portfolio. And that's not to say that we're going to just completely leave coal and leave petroleum, because we cannot do that. But it is an interesting trend, and the way this study came out is that we really focused on natural gas and the hydro as the key deliverers. So here is the what we call, this is the list. This is the list of the major projects that we need to accomplish in the next 50 years. Now, this is not granular. It's relatively high level, and there's many more recommendations in the plan. And there are certainly near-term issues that are dealt with. But notable here is the recommendation of a demand-side management energy efficiency program. And I have a slide to show you the expectation of the amount of actual energy savings that we can get from those programs. And remember that on the one hand, we have the supply side where we're generating and transmitting. And on the other side, we have the consumer. And you can either build power plants to produce a lot more energy, or you can induce or incent programs that cause people to use less energy or to use it more efficiently. Those two, the study recommends we need to do those in combination for our energy future in a big way. The DSM and energy efficiency is an important part of these recommendations. I'll just run down the list. Fire Island Wind Project is on the list. The South Central Power Plant Project that MLMP and Shugach is proposing is on the list. We have the Glacier Forks Hydro, which is up near the Kinnick Glacier, is on the list. A Nikiski Wind Project is on the list. There are several simple cycle gas turbines which are needed in order to make the system work and in order for our power portfolio to function. And then, of course, there is a parallel pursuit of both the Susitna projects and the Chacachana and Glacier Fork projects, which we're recommending that you don't pick the horse now. We need to continue the development of all of those. And each of them have unique characteristics and the benefits. Finally, we have quite a number of transmission projects. Now, here is, on the horizontal axis, is, again, the 50-year planning period. And this is, on the vertical axis, is the energy requirements. Now, the red is what would occur if we did not do the demand-side management and the energy efficiency. The green is with it. And I think you can see, I believe Mr. Harper's group has recommended that we may be able to achieve up to, I think it's 10%, Kevin, 10% savings, significant. Now, here's one of the key reasons for us to really participate with this GRETC process with the utilities. Mr. Harper's group has come up with the list, and they've looked at how much it's going to cost, and they've come up with a cost curve, again, by year, and you can see that over the 50-year period, this happens to be Plan 1A. There's a number of different options, but it is, I think, instructive. We'll need about $9 billion over the 50-year period. The utilities have the ability over that period really to raise somewhere between $1 and $5 billion over the 50-year period. There is a definite deficit in capital. They can't do it alone. That is the fundamental reason, one of the fundamental reasons why the state has put people like me to work on this and to really reach out to the utilities to create a solution so we can actually raise that capital. Now, another aspect of interesting aspect of this is that the utilities, nearly all of them, have current projects. They generally are charged with making sure the lights stay on for their individual service areas. And because we have six service areas, sometimes they behave a little bit like city-states, and there's maybe like a spruce tree stockade around. And so they say, we're just going to be self-sufficient. We're going to put our own generation in. For example, MEA has proposed a 180-megawatt gas-fired combined cycle plant to be placed near Eklutna. MLMP has proposed a number of simple cycle gas turbines and, I believe, a combined cycle upgrade. HEA has proposed a number of projects on the Kenai Peninsula. If we analyze this and include what we're calling these committed units and assume that they get built and assess all of the costs of ownership and operation, versus if we, rather than having those utilities build those individual projects, they join a combined GRETC process where GRETC builds projects to satisfy the rail belt needs as a whole. There, you can see that there are significant savings that GRETC will bring to the table. And so this information we've been sharing with the rail belt utilities, and we are in discussions with them on the manner that a potential GRETC could be used to save money for the ratepayer. So the takeaway tonight is that we've got, I think, a very interesting and viable renewable-based power portfolio. We have combined that and synchronized that with the creation of a company, privately owned but public-purpose company, that can, in the most efficient fashion, raise the money necessary for our future to achieve the least cost. Now, that's the recommendations in a nutshell. I kept it pretty short, and I hope you think it's short, but sweet, and you understood what I was saying. AEA has posted the integrated plan on its webpage. We're soliciting public comment, and over about a month period, we'll accept written public comment up until January 6th on the study. At that time, we will coalesce the comments, discuss them at the AEA level with Kevin, and our intention is to publish the final plan, let's put it this way, to publish the completed document by January 13th. So that is the schedule. And I did want to just give some recognition to the team. There's been quite a team here. We have looked at the financing capabilities of the utilities, and we've developed financing approaches so that the hydro projects are treated fairly in this economic competition. We've had extensive analysis work on the Susitna Hydro Project by the team headed up by Bob Butera, and there has been R&M Consultants has worked on the roller compacted concrete option. But I also wanted to recognize my co-project manager, Mr. Brian Carey, in our office. And lastly, Mr. Kevin Harper and Mr. Myron Rollins, who's not there with us tonight. So this has been a cooperative and collaborative process, basically over the last 2.5 years, to create the business structure, to begin the process of forming this company, and finally to do this plan. And we're very pleased to have it out on the web, and we hope that you'll read it, all of it, all 391 pages, and give us your good comments on them. So on behalf of the AEA, thank you very much for listening to me tonight. I'm certainly available for any questions.
You're listening to Jim Strandberg of the Alaska Energy Authority on KSKA's Addressing Alaskans. Hosted by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, Strandberg presented the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan, a 50-year long-range state-funded energy plan at the Anchorage Museum on Wednesday, December 9th. Following Mr. Strandberg's talk, Kevin Harper from Black & Veatch Engineering joined him in responding to questions from the audience.
All right, the question was, looked like some of the transmission costs may be at par or higher than the generation costs, and could you comment on the way the transmission planning was done? I'll give a start on that. Maybe Mr. Harper would like to come up and make a comment on that. There's two aspects to the transmission planning. One is, when is it economic to build a transmission line for a given area? And would it be better just to build a generator in that area or to build a transmission line? That is one way to look at this. The other way is under the Gretzky concept and a large-scale hydro project, there's going to be a need to have a robust backbone so that that power can flow everywhere in the rail belt. And I think there are total costs of wholesale power expressed in the study, and I think Mr. Harper can kind of address really the relationship between that wholesale power cost and the transmission cost. Mr. Harper.
Okay, thanks, Jim. In total, we have a total of, I think, 14 fairly large transmission projects identified that combine is about $1.2 billion over the next 15 years. So remember the slide that Jim had that showed about $9.5 billion investment. About $1.5 billion of that is related to transmission. The other $8 billion would be generation. Now, in the report, when we go through all of the analysis of the capital costs and operating costs and so forth, we have some tables that show what the unit cost of power is. That unit cost includes both generation and transmission in it. So we don't separate in the report the generation-only costs and the transmission-only costs, so they're combined. And then in terms of the types of projects that we've looked at, there's really five different types of projects. One is projects that need to be done basically to replace aging transmission infrastructure. You know, much of the transmission was built in the 40s and 50s and 60s. And so regardless of what you do in the future, you've got to replace some lines and some equipment to keep that system up. The second category of transmission investments are the investments that are necessary to achieve the concept that's behind Gretzky, as Jim mentioned, which is a robust transmission network that allows you to move power throughout the area to take maximum advantage of economies of scale and also reliable service. So in essence, those types of investments are building redundant lines up and down the network. The third type of investment, it relates to new generation projects. You have to connect those projects to the grid. So those are interconnection projects. And then fourth is there are certain projects like Chacachana or any of the large projects that in addition to interconnecting to the network, you have to kind of do some things to strengthen the network to really be able to move all of that power up and down. And then the fifth category relates to projects that are necessary to deal with frequency issues, and this is specific to non-dispatchable resources like wind. Okay, one of the advantages of using gas or fossil fuels is you can regulate the generation, the level of generation, to match the demand, which really has to occur on an instantaneous basis. When you have a non-dispatchable resource, that becomes a challenge. There's things that you can do to address that, and one of them is dealing with putting in our case, what we assumed was putting in a battery system down in the either Anchorage or Kenai area to provide that ability to regulate the frequency on the system. So those are the five types of projects. In total, around $1.2 billion. And again, they're included in that overall unit cost of power with the generation.
So, yeah. The question is, right now, who owns the transmission lines? And under Gretzky, who would own them? Currently, it's a patchwork quilt. Thank you. It gives me a platform. The ownership and commercial agreement structure within the rail belt is quite complex right now. When the makers of the network put it together, they incrementally build from a very small system, and that required a considerable number of commercial agreements between different utilities to actually move power. And indeed, their practice and their style until I'd say 20 years ago, was to produce power within their service area and keep it there. But as the network became gradually more integrated, transmission lines were built. Some of them are owned by the state, but many of them are owned by individual utilities. And under the concept of Gretzky, some of those and assets would stay in the ownership of the utilities. New projects would be built and would be owned by Gretzky. But this ownership issue and the transition of those commercial agreements into a Gretzky environment where the commercial business structure is much simpler will take a significant amount of time and elbow grease. And I hope that answered your question. Thank you. The question is, given the high cost of fuel in rural, remote Alaska, is there an additional piece to the integrated plan to address those communities that are off the grid? Well, again, a very good question. Certainly, if the state puts its financial muscle into evolving this network and raising the capital, there would be some quid pro quo, I guess you could call it, or some expectation that the state would also participate in rural Alaska in a similar fashion, and that's been the style here for many years. At the present time, we have done some financial modeling that involves a potential surcharge. And you know the old saying, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh. If there is significant state funding that is put into this project that results in a significantly lower cost of wholesale power, well, we've provided in the modeling, without making any recommendation, the ability to have a surcharge. And again, that's going to be politically charged, but certainly that is a possibility for the policymakers to consider. Beyond that, the rail belt system really is being developed for the benefit of the ratepayers within the rail belt. Let's see if I can get this. Will the study comment process accommodate the belief that six utilities sharing a load of 750 average megawatts is borderline in size and that the situation will continue to bedevil us? Well, as I said, that is an issue. It's clearly an issue about whether or not the utility should evolve and consolidate so that they can lessen their costs of delivery for the energy. This study deals with the generation and transmission aspects, where, you know, there's just a major portion of capitalization that needs to occur for generation and transmission. But for the questioner, you know, certainly I think that is an issue that is on the lips of many people right now. Why was Chaka Chamna selected over Susitna? Well, it wasn't actually selected over Susitna. I think the actual recommendation of the study is that the development and analysis of both Chaka Chamna and Susitna should continue. Because of the particular characteristics of the Chaka Chamna project, where it's not a dam project, but it's a lake tap, the economics of that project are different from the Susitna. Now, Susitna has a very large basin, and there's possible to incrementally build projects in Susitna to get a whole heck of a lot of power. And Chaka Chamna is a relatively small project, a single-phase project. So I would say that the results of the study indicate more that we need to further develop both projects rather than picking either one. The second question is, was there an environmental analysis of Chaka Chamna done at the level of Susitna? And the answer is clearly no. We do not know as much about the Chaka Chamna project as we do about the Susitna project. And very clearly, there is some expectation that the fisheries issues on Chaka Chamna need to be looked at much more in much more detail before we can begin to really emphasize that project. Will the analysis of Chaka Chamna postpone decisions on which to choose? I'm not sure that it will postpone, but I think that for completeness and just the due diligence of all of our resources, we are going to need to look at it to do our due diligence on that project. Would GRETSI necessitate utility consolidation, or do you anticipate utility consolidating under GRETSI? Well, actually, I think that's a pretty good question. The GRETSI process is designed to be a voluntary process. The consolidation of the G&T assets of the utilities, there can be no takings. It needs to be designed so that it is a win-win. And, you know, my expectation is that there is an approach that could be developed that will allow the utilities over time to evolve from their present city-state approach to a more centralized G&T. In that sense, the utilities are really consolidating their over time their G&T assets into GRETC. As far as the distribution side, I think that is a separate but related subject, which I expect others will take up, and we will be good listeners on that particular issue. Will the Greater Rail Belt Utility, the GRETC, be regulated by the RCA? If not, who will regulate? Our GRETC drafting group involved lawyers from the utilities, technical staff, and two commissioners from the RCA. It is currently before us exactly how to handle the regulatory treatment of the new company. I would comment that literally all of the major energy projects that have been accomplished in the state to date have been what we call non-jurisdictional, i.e. they're not regulated by the RCA. That being said, we are working with the RCA and very much considering that issue right now, so I can't give you the definite answer. But, for example, the Bradley Lake project, which my agency owns, is not regulated by the RCA. Instead, there are specific bond covenants which very much direct how the project is managed and operated. Another good question. Your multi-power source graphic showed natural gas being fairly consistent and even increasing after 2020. What source do you base this on? Are you assuming the North Slope pipeline, or are you assuming new yet untapped Cook Inlet sources? Mr. Harper, you want to field that?
Okay, so two parts of that question. Okay, so Jim read the first part of the question. Let me read the second part, and then we'll explain it on the graph. And the second part is that some graphic, and I think it's this graphic, showed that tidal energy is producing currently and terminating in 2020. And so let's discuss the natural gas first and then discuss tidal. It is correct that you'll see the natural gas after 2020 slowly goes up. It largely is kind of a constant percentage of overall energy. Underlying that is a forecast of gas supply availability and prices that we developed. We did some fairly significant work in this area. We looked at a lot of published documents, and we developed a probabilistic decision tree model, which looked at the various potential gas supply options that are out there, the likelihood of them coming online, and the amount of gas that they would represent, and then looked at a variety of different scenarios, and then that led into a supply-demand gas price forecasting model. And we met with a number of producers and electric utilities, DNR, and other folks to help inform that model. The model is based on a couple things. First of all, we have the benefit of some very recent work done by DNR in terms of their expectations of what future gas supplies in the Cook Inlet are going to be. We got this information prior to them releasing the current study that they're working on. So this is kind of a pre-release, but it was such an important element that they gave us the information their best estimate at the time. It also assumes that, you know, there's significant gas up in the North Slope, and we looked at two options in terms of way to get that gas down to the rail belt. It could either be the bullet line or the spur line. Now, in our analysis, we did not look at the economics or the risk of whether the bullet line was better than the spur line. We just simply said it was an in-state pipeline. It could be either one. But through that, there would be significant supplies that would come down into the Cook Inlet. We also assumed two different types of LNG supplies. The first type of supplies would be short-term, kind of transitional LNG for the next 3, 4, 5 years, just to help get over the near-term gas supply issue. And the way this type of LNG works is basically it comes over the ship. The ship just sits there, and you basically run out a big hose to the ship, and you just pull off the gas. That works in the short term. That works if you're talking about a relatively small amount, but that doesn't work if that becomes your primary source of gas. And that's the second option of LNG that we looked at, which was large, long-term tankers for of LNG as being an option relative to North Slope or Cook Inlet. So we looked at those different sources of supply, different probabilities of them occurring, and came up with an overall prediction of gas supply availability and an overall prediction of gas prices. And that's what fed into the model. So what this says is, you see the increase, that says that, you know, in that time frame, our assumption is that there will be enough gas to have a slight increase, okay, as you see that. But the thing that I think is important to note here is not that it's slightly increasing from the year 2020 on, but how much of a decrease it is from the current level of gas. Okay, so you see that big drop-off in the next, you know, 10 years of gas and fuel oil dropping off, okay, and then it's slowly rising. So our projection of the use of natural gas for electric generation in the rail belt going forward is significantly less than what it is today. Now, the other question had to do with tidal, and I think there's a misunderstanding of the color, and I apologize because I can see it's hard to read. The green that you see on the left over there is actually purchase power as opposed to tidal. So we do not, in this picture, we do not have any tidal included in that. Now, we did not include tidal as an alternative resource in our base cases, largely because, in our view, it is not commercial enough in terms of development to be fair comparison to wind and geothermal and so forth. Now, clearly over 50 years, that's not going to be the case. Clearly, you have world-class tidal resources. Okay, so one of the sensitivity cases we did look at was what happens if you put tidal in. And that actually looks very promising from an economic standpoint. I think, as most of you probably know, there's some significant environmental issues that has to do with placing these kinds of facilities, you know, in the tidal flow and the impact that that would have, and in your case here specifically on the beluga whale situation. But we think tidal is a very promising technology. We don't include it only because we made a determination of what we believed was commercially demonstrated today. And tidal is right on the cusp, in our view. It's not there today, but it's going to be there probably within the next 5 years, certainly is a proven technology that's commercially economic. It's a proven technology. I would just say it hasn't been proven yet to be commercially economic in terms of application. Okay, so the next question is, what types of commercial energy efficiency programs is the AEA looking at? And any discussion on decoupling utilities selling more power from profits? Okay, so that they are incentivized to promote energy efficiency to their commercial users. Okay, so one of the issues you have, specifically with regards to DSM and energy efficiency, is you have a limited amount of Alaska-specific information, and you have a limited amount of Alaska-specific experience. So in our analysis of DSM and energy efficiency measures, we took the information we could from Alaska and we supplemented that with work that we've done ourselves in other parts of the country as well as other nationally published reports to look at the different types of measures in residential and commercial that make sense in general and then also make sense in a cold environment. So on the commercial side, we looked at weatherization, cooling, heating, water heating, lighting, you know, kind of what I would consider to be kind of the standard proven measures that you see in many other parts. And we basically assumed an implementation curve, kind of like the S curves that Jim was talking about for technology costs, using experience elsewhere. And we put those directly into the model, and the model could pick as much as we gave it. And in essence, it picked as much as we gave it. We kind of capped it at a 10%. Arguably, you could get more than 10, but we felt 10% was, given where you are now, pretty aggressive. It is less than what you see in other states like California, Wisconsin, New York, that are at the leading edge of DSM energy efficiency. Okay, but it's not that far behind them. California right now is about 15%, so you're looking at 10%. That's, you know, that achieving that would be pretty significant. So that's how we build up the DSM energy efficiency information. Now, our model doesn't deal with rates in terms of choosing among resources. It basically deals with just overall economic costs. But the second point is a very important one, which is that one of the problems that you have in a utility environment promoting DSM energy efficiency is most utilities, including the ones up here, the rates are based upon recovery of costs divided by an estimate of how many units are going to be sold. Okay, and inherently there is a incentive to sell more, because you get more revenue. Okay, now, I would argue that incentive up here is less because you have public cooperatives and municipalities than it is elsewhere where you have investor-owned utilities. Okay, but that reality is still there. And in our report, we do talk, albeit to a limited degree, about the need to look at dealing with the rate structure so that you remove that incentive to sell more. Okay. I'll take this one. Okay. How widespread is the use of residential solar hot water heating systems being considered with their 75% efficiency rate? What we included in the study is we have a couple solar measures that were included in the DSM energy efficiency models. I can't tell you off the top of my head how much of that was chosen. We kind of roll things up, you know, different types of measures up to a total for residential and a total for commercial. So I'd have to go back and actually look at how much is in there. But that certainly is a promising alternative for the area.
Another good question. This study provides for the electrical consumption of Rail Belt Alaska. What is being done to provide gas for heat for Alaskan homes since the Cook Inlet is running out of natural gas? The energy situation is, shall we say, multifaceted. The basis of this study was to aggregate or consider all of the demand for natural gas in the region. Even though the analysis was focused on the need for gas for the rail belt electrical generation, there is considerable work being done by both NSTAR and the Department of Natural Resources to address this very issue. There has been considerable talk about creating a overall resource plan, energy resource plan for Cook Inlet. And I can say that this particular analysis, I think, looked at holistically at the Cook Inlet because it needed to set up an economic price for the natural gas that the utilities would buy. But the actual resource plan for the natural gas is work that is underway right now. And AEA is going to work with DNR and NSTAR to make sure that we coordinate the plan for generation with this resource plan that's being put together. Okay. Thank you very much, folks.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans. This week's program featured Jim Strandberg from the Alaska Energy Authority addressing the Renewable Energy Alaska Project at their monthly forum held at the Anchorage Museum. Strandberg outlined South Central's energy options over the next 50 years. Then he responded to questions from the audience, along with his colleague Kevin Harper, a project manager with Black & Veatch Engineering. You can hear the complete question and answer portion of the program on our website at kska.org, where you can also find a link to the Regional Integrated Resource Plan draft report on the State of Alaska's website. Jim Strandberg's talk, entitled "The Integrated Resource Plan for the Alaskan Rail Belt, A Rational Economic Plan for the Future," was recorded on Wednesday, December 9th, 2009. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.